Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Sam Rogers, a candidate for state Senate in New York's 53rd Senate District. He's running on the Republican, Conservative, Independence, and Sam party lines and is challenging first-term Democratic Senator Rachel May. Senator May appeared previously on the program, and you can find that interview on the Campbell Conversations webpage at wrvo.org. Sam is an attorney and works for the Madison County's District Attorney's Office. He's also a graduate student at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, where I also teach. But we are not in the same programs, and we have not interacted at Syracuse. The 53rd Senate District consists of Madison County and parts of Oneida and Onondaga counties, including the majority of the city of Syracuse. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Grant. Thanks for having me on this morning. You know, I've really enjoyed your show, your talks with previous candidates and elected officials, so I'm really excited and honored to talk with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let me just start with a basic overview question to give our listeners a sense of what are the things that you're emphasizing in your campaign. What would you say are the one or two main themes of your campaign?
The main theme, and to be fair, you know, we kind of have a pre-coronavirus and now a post-coronavirus situation we're dealing with. But the economy and, you know, the budget issues that we're facing in New York, I think now it's more critical than ever. And, you know, I came to Syracuse. I played football on the Syracuse football team. I went to law school after that. And my wife and I, Jenna, had a decision to make whether we wanted to follow the law career kind of down to New York City or stay here in central New York. And we came to the decision together that we have everything we want here and we love it. And we're tired of our friends moving away. And I know a lot of people are tired of, you know, their kids or their grandkids or their friends also moving away. And we believe that we can be a good example to encourage and inspire other people to do the same thing because we're willing to kind of work with the system and make this, you know, a great place for everyone. So it's that economy and creating those jobs and those opportunities for people to stay, which is a big theme and a big opportunity for me as an elected official.
So we'll get into some of this, I think, a little bit later in our conversation, but just very, very briefly here, what do you think are the biggest things that are keeping that from happening as far as you understand it? What's holding the state back from being able to achieve the goal that you just articulated?
Right now, we're facing a problem of out-migration. You know, there was an article posted just yesterday in the Post Standard about, you know, we're continually losing population. And a lot of that has to do with the job opportunities. And kind of within that is our tax structure where we're just causing people to flee. And, you know, I'd say people that are deciding where to live, you know, in their late 20s or 30s, they might not be thinking too much about, you know, the tax structure, but they are thinking about the job opportunities. And the tax structure is influencing those job opportunities because it's hard to do business in New York. Our business culture makes it very, very difficult. And that needs to be changed if we want to attract and keep people here. And so that's an opportunity that I see as, look, I'm someone, my wife Jenna and I is someone who decided that this is a great place to live and we can make it even better if we address some of these issues.
So your campaign website, one of the things that it emphasizes is the importance of agriculture for Central New York. And you suggest, I think, on the information that's there that both the state legislature and the incumbent senator have prioritized downstate interests over the interests of agriculture. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
100%. You know, I don't think it's a secret to anyone that up here in Central New York, we're kind of always wrestling with or battling the downstate interests. That's just the way that our state is set up with New York City and Central New York. And you've seen my opponent has voted, you know, consistently with that downstate interest. And one example that you kind of alluded to is the Farm Worker Labor Act. And, you know, that act really, really hurt our local farms kind of out in Madison County. And it's votes like that where, you know, you're just turning your back on, you know, central New York and the dairy industry, the farming industry that we rely on, and just aligning and following suit with kind of the majority in the legislature.
So would there be any tensions for you if you were to win, given what you've said there, looking at those issues and prioritizing those issues, given the fact that you would be representing most of the city of Syracuse? So that those interests may be somewhat different. How would you square that?
So you're right, and you touch on a point that really needs to be looked into, and it's, you know, our district is drawn so oddly, where, you know, you have a representative who is representing Madison County, parts of Oneida County, northern parts of Onondaga and southern parts of Onondaga, and then the city of Syracuse. Very divergent interests, as you've alluded to. And that's where, you know, we need someone that has the open mind, that's willing to wrestle with the issues and willing to think and be considerate and kind of see it from all angles. And right now, I feel, and a lot of people I've talked to feel, that, you know, the incumbent is just very kind of isolated with her perspectives. And that's what's being pushed through. And it's being seen by just completely aligning with, you know, the downstate kind of legislative majority.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with New York State Senate candidate Sam Rogers. Well, you said at the beginning there's the pre-COVID and sort of post-COVID versions of your campaign. I wanted to talk a little bit about the COVID crisis. First of all, how would you evaluate the state of New York's response to COVID so far? Are there things you would have liked to have seen done differently? Has it been fairly successful in your view?
I would evaluate it with this. And I would predicate it on, you know, this is novel to everyone. And that's why, you know, it's the novel coronavirus. And there is a margin of error with that. There is, you know, things that we cannot expect, and we just have to attack it the best we can. When you say the New York's response, I think that can be boiled down to really the governor's response. And I'll get into why that's kind of a problem here in a little bit. But to kind of box it up, I would say New York State's response spoiled with time. And what I mean by that is, you know, at the beginning, a lot of things were happening. And I think we were getting pretty good feedback that, you know, tough decisions, we were shutting things down, things had to happen quickly. And within that, the legislature voted to give the governor very, very broad unilateral powers to make decisions that needed to be made. And as that continued, you know, as you'd expect with the burden of the decisions that are happening, things started to get worse. And what's bad with what the legislature did is they gave him power for over a year to deal with this crisis, where it should have been, you know, you're going to have these powers to get things going in the way we need, you know, for 15 days, and then we'll reevaluate. But that's not happening. And with that burden, I think the governor's response, as you would expect, you know, carrying that burden has gotten a little worse. And two specific examples is one with the communication. At the beginning, he got a lot of credit for being a clear communicator. And then, you know, 2 weeks ago, we saw when we were trying to open phase two here in central New York, the communication went completely out the window. And I think part of that is because he didn't have the legislature to rely on to help him. You know, where was our representative as a liaison between our county executive and the governor? Nowhere to be seen. The legislature gave him this power and then just kind of went home. And then the second, which, you know, is kind of more relevant to this race, to the 53rd district, and what the governor will kind of always be the asterisk with his response, is the nursing home tragedy that has really unfolded in New York. And I'm sure a lot of people have read headlines and kind of know that there's something going on there. But for any of the listeners that don't quite know how or why it unfolded, was in March 25th, Governor Cuomo signed an executive order that made nursing homes, they weren't allowed to deny patients based on their COVID status, which is just very inconsistent with what we knew about the coronavirus and just with nursing homes in general. And I like to be someone that is optimistic. But I've talked to people, you know, this week that said, Sam, this is a scandal. There was plenty of beds down in the Javits Center, in the Navy hospital boat in New York City where these patients could have went to. But having them go to nursing homes is just completely tragic. And I touched on this is very relevant to my race because my opponent is the chair of the aging committee in the state Senate. I see that position as possibly the best positioned person in the state government to stand up to the governor and at least question the logic of this executive order. But there was nothing said, and there's still been very little said by my incumbent about this order. And it's just been tragic effects, and it's, you know, the silence from our representative just can't be accepted.
Mm. And let's look at the national government level here too, with the pandemic. How would you evaluate the Trump administration's response to the COVID crisis, and in particular, the president's leadership on the issue?
So the president definitely gave kind of the economic side of the equation, and you know, one thing talking about health economics and everything is there is a balance to be had. I think our state, you've seen the balance fall more towards the health part of the equation. The federal government, I think you saw the balance fall more to the economic side of the conversation. And that's two differences in the approaches. I think the president also, you know, from the beginning kind of relied on the federalism aspect of our government, which, like it or not, that's kind of how it's set up. That a situation like this is a state response. And so that's why you see different responses in New York or in Florida or California. And that's just kind of a decision that, you know, our country is built on, is this federalism aspect where the states are able to tailor their response to what they see their region needs.
Do you have any concerns about, or did you have any concerns about the way that the president was talking about information that was coming from the scientific community and from some of his own science advisors?
I think, you know, what I said at the beginning is this novel response is hard for everyone. It's new to everyone. I think there is a scientific aspect that needs to be looked at. But with that, there's also a political science aspect that needs to be looked at, which I explained about the federalism and kind of the state response. So I think, you know, again, there's margins for error in this new everyone kind of trying to figure it out on the fly. But giving, you know, the states their autonomy for their response is kind of the path that the president took. And I think that's the path that, you know, our government has kind of organized to do.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sam Rogers. He's challenging Democrat incumbent State Senator Rachel May in New York's 53rd Senate District this November. Well, let's now move to another issue that's been occupying the headlines for quite some time, and that is the response to the police killing of George Floyd. There have been many protests happening around the country and around New York State, including here in Syracuse. And it's become another flashpoint in racial politics in this country. And it does look like it's going to lead to some policy changes regarding policing. And we'll get into some of those policy changes that are likely in the state of New York in a minute. But let me ask a more general question first. Sam, do you have just a view about the protests themselves?
The protests, as I see them, are, you know, valid expressions of emotion from, you know, the Black and minority community. one in our area and around the country. And it, you know, the whole situation with George Floyd, his family, and then the emotions that leads to our friends in this area is just sad and devastating. And you know, I see that as a valid expression of kind of the pain and the anger of what they're going through. I think it needs to be distinguished, and I'm sure we'd get into it. You know, I think there's a distinguish between the protesting and the rioting and looting that we kind of saw happen at the beginning. And that I see that as two different groups. And I draw that distinction because I think we also need to draw a distinction between, you know, the police officers that are doing their job well and serving the community, and ones that, you know, don't. And that's kind of what we saw with the George Floyd situation. And, you know, so I want to make that distinguishing factor there. But, you know, the protests in general, I see as a valid expression of the pain that people are going through. And I think, you know, in Syracuse specifically, you know, we had one night of where it got into the rioting and looting and kind of the different area. But I think we've really done a good job of being peaceful. And I think that goes to the leaders of the protests in this area, you know, the people from the Last Chance for Change group that have kind of taken this on. I think they've done a pretty good job of keeping them peaceful in Syracuse. And I think that's what kind of leaves the impression in people's minds, which is a good thing as we confront this issue.
So let's look at more of the policy outcomes of this, or the likely ones. This week, the state legislature passed a whole raft of measures regarding police policy, and they include what's been called a right to record police activity, outlawing chokeholds by the police, mandating courts to collect data on more than 20 demographic metrics for any arrest, repealing a law that kept police disciplinary records secret, establishing a unit of the Attorney General's office to review misconduct complaints to about the police, and mandating body-worn cameras for any state trooper on parole. Most of these measures passed the legislature by wide margins, some a little bit more on party votes, but Senator May, I believe, voted in favor of all these changes. Would you have voted differently on any one of these policies? Do you see problems with any of these changes that the legislature is proposing?
So the legislation from this week, and you definitely mentioned there's a raft of it coming through, it shows that good intentions doesn't always breed well-written legislation. And I think with that, it's worth talking about the standard that we hold our legislators to for their actual job of legislating is so low right now. And, you know, we put them under a microscope when it comes to what they say or what endorsements they have, what groups they align with. But we don't pay enough attention to the actual legislating that they're doing. And I think this conversation needs to be predicated with, you know, good legislation would come from the messy place in the middle. And what I mean by that is a place where you detest racism, call it out for what it is. It is evil. It's an evil of humanity. And you have to absolutely go in with the mindset that you detest racism. But that collides with the fact that there are police officers that when they do their job well and when they're serving the community, it is a dangerous and difficult job to do. So with that predicate, you know, I think a lot of the legislation that has passed this week kind of falls into three categories. And the first category is, okay, that makes sense. You know, I might not have thought of to do it that way quite, but I see what they're doing and it makes sense. The second is, okay, that kind of reaffirms something that is already a right. Some of it's pandering to the emotions of the situation, which can be affirmative and can be a good thing. And then the final category is that was a missed opportunity where we didn't dive in and think about the implication. So quickly, you know, the ones that I see, you know, okay, that sounds prudent. That sounds good. Courts collecting data, that's a good thing. The prosecution of the, you know, the special prosecution unit in the Attorney General, you know, I'm a state prosecutor now. And I look at that, I know people in my office have the discretion to, if they're in a situation, they could recuse themselves. I believe a lot of district attorneys in the same way know and have judgment when they should recuse themselves. However, I also know that, you know, in my study of law, a perceived conflict of interest is a conflict of interest. So in my job, I work with police officers a lot, and I can see that, you know, if one of them was accused of something, it might make sense to have an outside group come in and review that. So that's a law that, okay, you know, I may have thought about it a little differently, but I understand what's being put forth. So the second group is, you know, this is just kind of reaffirming rights that we already had. And, you know, that's the right to record. You could always record police officers. This just kind of puts a line on, you know, what a police officer can say to make you stop recording. Also the chokehold, that is, you know, it's always been a crime if you cause serious injury or kill somebody, you know, and you don't have a valid affirmative defense. So the chokehold just kind of reestablishes that in a way that is kind of grounded in what we've seen recently. And then the third category, and this is where I kind of want to dig in a little bit and talk about, you know, the Civil Rights 50A specific law. And this is the category where I think we really miss an opportunity to actually, you know, do something that if we would have dove into that messy middle that I talked about, we could have found, you know, a really good law. And I think the first problem is it's set up as, you know, you're either siding with one side or the other. Like I talked about earlier, people are just jumping to their sides, and that's not good. And that's causing some problems with this law. But for people that maybe just heard or read headlines, don't know exactly what it is 50-A, you know, to put it simply, it protects police disciplinary records and records that, you know, a police office might use for, you know, evaluating promotion or evaluating performance of their officers. And so what happened is that was repealed. And so that law, you know, you got to think about what is the purpose of repealing this law. And I see two purposes that people are looking to accomplish. And one is to be transparent. And two, the most important one is for accountability. And so appealing this law, I see, has three outcomes, three possible outcomes. The first no one really talked about, and that is, are we motivating police units to not keep records that we want them to keep? Because if they're going to become public information where the public can see, that's something that we need to talk about. And I didn't see it talked about. The second and third outcomes are the ones where the debate is happening the most. And so the second is, you know, if we make these individual records public information, is that going to lead to harassment to our police officers? Is that going to make their job harder than it is? Is it going to make their job unsafe? Is it going to make their family's job unsafe if they get harassed? And the third is, you know, it might actually cause, one, police officers to adjust their behavior, or two, be able to, you know, get them out of the system if they are, you know, in a way where their disciplinary records are for public consumption. And I think the missed opportunity is right there, where, you know, if we would have dove in and thought about this, what if the law instead, you know, it doesn't make the individualized record public, where, you know, that officer can be harassed, but it makes the group's record public, where it's not individual, but it's the group. Because I think that would start to change the culture. That would start to get, you know, the people, the good cops that are there, where there are so many of them, to really change the culture and detest, you know, the bad policing that we see. And a quick example of that is when I was on the Syracuse football team, we had team rules. And there were some team rules that the punishment was, you know, you had to get up and run at 6 a.m. And those type of rules, when people broke them, it was, well, at least that's not me. You know, I don't break those rules. The second type of team rules made the whole team get up at 6 a.m. and run. And I'll tell you what, when I was a captain of the football team, those rules being broken was unacceptable. And if they were, we confronted the people that were breaking them and we demanded a behavior change. And I think that gets at the heart of what we're trying to do here is accountability and aligning interests to really make a big difference.
So we've only got literally a minute left, but I wanted to give you a chance to unpack that. I think the details are important, but just in a minute, I'm putting you in a tough place, but I want to fit one more question in. The state budget is obviously facing a huge deficit. It seems to be growing. We may get help at the federal level, but we may not in the state of New York, or not enough to cover this. If cuts are necessary, where would you be looking to make them? And really just give me the titles of the subject areas, because we really are at the end here.
You got to cut waste first. And, you know, that comes in different government projects, and I could get into that. But you got to look at waste. And then second, Grant, as legislators and government officials, we need to lead by example. We build trust by saying, you know, we're willing to do what we're asking you to do. I think there's perks with being a legislative official that could be cut to save money and to show the public that, look, we're in this with you and we're here to represent you.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was New York State Senate candidate Sam Rogers. He's running in the 53rd Senate District this November. Sam, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Grant, I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your show, and thanks for having me.
We were glad to have you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.